Yeah, what's up? It's your boy Joel Ortiz, and I want everybody to make sure that they subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenko. Yo, Tim, I hope all is well. You my guy. I know these interviews are not interviews. They're actually conversations, and I appreciate them all. Yeah.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ice-T. I want you to do something for me. Make sure you download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenko. It is official. All right, stop playing. Download and subscribe. Library Rap, the hip hop interviews with Tim Einenko. It's cold. Mom raised me. This is me. Like winter is cold, skin covers bones. You see, I remain like the sun after rain for your soul. Yeah, you wanna see, you wanna roll with me, you wanna be.
In 2005, when I first heard the album, it's called Life by Eternia, I was amazed by the bars, the confidence, the wordplay, the everything Eternia displayed on the album. She's about to drop a new album called Free with Rel McCoy. That said, 16 years later, she continues to display what makes her great and what makes hip-hop great. Eternia, welcome to Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenko. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh man, that was a great introduction. Thank you. I didn't know you were familiar with It's Called Life. That's like only the heads know It's Called Life. I won't preach to you. I'm from the same system, and that ain't my mission. I'm just one seed, and I can't be everything to everybody. No reason, no logic. Mad superstars lack content. Don't rock it. Find a new topic, and that's the ironic part of this thing. Like you can't earn respect in this game until you.
So in college, I did a. I grew up in New York City, and I, you know, went through this whole stage of in the 90s of like whatever was on the radio I couldn't deal with type stuff, and then I got really, and then my friend in 97 played me, or 98 played me Black Star's album, and I was in college at the time, and I was like, I gotta play this for the masses, you know. And then I got really into that kind of just like, you know, listen to Black Star, but then listen to Wordsworth, and, you know, get into the, like, everyone. So then after I graduated 2001, I continued, obviously, before kids, to still delve in the music. And then I found you, and I was like, oh my God, this is incredible, you know?
Thank you. That was my era too. Black Star was definitely like a, you know, like a, just a really seminal, or whatever the word you want to use. It was just really, it marked my coming of age time, my teenage years.
You're a Canadian artist, right? You're from Canada. And you think about artists that paved the way for Canadian artists, you have to think of My Show, Fresh West, and Michi Me, right?
Yes.
So these are two MCs that helped pave the way. What were, and you know, and you could talk about how Black Star, and please do, about how they impacted you as well, but what were these two artists, what were their impact on you? And then how, from what you saw of them, how do you incorporate kind of them into you as, you know, yourself, the artist at Eternia?
It's a good question. Yeah. So I'm just trying to remember, my first memory of Maestro Fresh West would probably be seeing him, his music videos on television, late 80s, or maybe I heard Backbone Slide before I saw it, but I just remember it, Backbone Slide. So I was a child when Maestro dropped, and he definitely was somebody that was as large to us as any other single or like pop group that we were listening to at the time. He was huge, is huge, continues to be huge. And we used to do our own, so in the 80s, late 80s, my father owned this camera, and most people didn't have home video recording at the time, but my father had this, like, it was like a studio grade, like journalist size camera, like huge, with those big belt packs, and we used to set it up on a tripod. We had all the gear, and we used to do these music videos, and we would lip sync to the music that we were listening to. This is all directed by my brother, and my father was a nightclub owner and a studio owner, so he had a lot of actual real instruments and gear. So our music videos were with real instruments, like full-size congas and drum sets and trumpets and you know, keyboards and like the real stuff. And we'd set it up, and so Backbone Slide was definitely one of the ones that we were lip-syncing to when I was before the age of 10. Later, full circle, my first music video or single really in life, Sorrow Song, one of my first singles in life, solo singles that is, he ended up being in the music video, and in the video he kind of acts as a mentor and kind of, you know, kind of shoves me off onto the stage. You know, he speaks some wisdom in my ear and gives me a hug and just kind of, so there was like kind of like this thing where Maestro was passing the torch in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I rocked his gear in that video. We've been really good friends ever since. He's such a head. He's such a fan of other people's artistry and emceeing. He gets so excited about other people and how they, like, he gets inspired by the younger generation. He's amazing. He stays young forever. He still looks as young as he did. Yeah. So Maestro was definitely like some of my earliest memories of listening to music as a kid and being hype, and Mishimi too. But I remember Mishimi, I think just because of my age, I remember her the most in Ragadeth, mm-hmm. which was this this metal group that she was a part of. And then of course I remember that joint she did with Estero that was later. I think it was Don't Want to Be Your Slave or whatever, Slave, maybe it was called. But yeah, Mishi too is just like, at the time, I mean, Maestro and Mishi were in the States and just like hanging out with and shoulder to shoulder with Big Daddy Kane or with, you know, the female counterparts at the time. They were huge. It wasn't just Canadian hip hop history. They are a part of hip hop history.
Right.
And they still are honored as legends to this day, which I think is really important. And it's really dope that I can say that I can call them friends and I guess in a way peers, although obviously I look up to them, but we get to rock the same stages sometimes and do shows together and see each other backstage. And that's just like a beautiful, it's always full circle. It's always really beautiful.
Is that always a weird thing for you? I mean, was anything surprising, I guess, about when you first, you know, met them or, you know, I always feel like, you know, you look up to these people and then you meet them and then you're just like in awe, right? Of the entire, you know, yeah. Like, what do I do? Yeah. Or
also I was in awe of like Kish, Dream Warriors. These are other Canadian acts that when I finally met, I was like, oh my gosh. And you know, everyone has been so cool. Like, I think sometimes you get nervous meeting people you look up to because they might not live up to what you have in your mind. Maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe they'll be rude to you, but these people are not. They are just full of love and light and just really gracious, really professional. I think they know that, like, you know, you don't know who's on your way up or who's on their way out, and they just treat everyone with dignity and respect. And yeah, it's just cool to meet people that you admire and then just be like, yo, you are just really cool. I get a lot of wisdom from Wes all the time. Every single time I see him, it could be 10 minutes. He's like dropping down. Like, he's just like, yo, here's this wisdom for you. Here's this wisdom for you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's so. I want to turn to, so, you know, my understanding, and I, you know, prior to us recording the interview, I, you know, talked to you about the Canadian laws and radio play and air, you know, TV play, and how about, I think it's about 35% of our Canadian artists are to be played on the airwaves before British or American music is played. Can you talk about kind of these laws, but also how have they helped you think as an artist, but also do they hurt artists at all? Or is it, I mean, cause they're trying, I don't know if they're trying too hard, if that's a good phrase for it, but can you just talk about how this is helpful for Canadian artists, but also if it's hurtful at all?
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause it's almost been like, you know, when you're a fish and you swim in the ocean, you don't really think about the water. It's been something that's been there since before I was doing music. And so I almost CanCon, the percentage of CanCon is what we call it, Canadian content. And I never really thought about it. I think at one point the percentage was higher, could be wrong, but I think at one point it was higher. That's just my memory, but I'd have to fact check that. But it's very necessary, extremely necessary. So, and the reason why is because otherwise, so American media and culture, whether it be TV or radio or the music industry, whatever, it just has so much more infrastructure and financial backing behind it that without that mandatory 35% of Canadian content, we would just get swallowed up with 100% of American content by virtue of the fact that, you know, sometimes it's bigger budgets and it's more exciting and they're better at marketing and promotion and they're, and you know, all these things. When I started doing hip hop in Canada, BET was not a station that we could access in Canada. MTV was not a station we could access in Canada, except for if you had like satellite or something, but not like regular cable. And other American outlets were not accessible. And of course, the internet wasn't like that yet. So it was kind of beautiful because in a sense, it created this bubble of, not a complete bubble, everyone was still trying to access American content, but it created a little bit of a safety net for Canadian artists to develop uniquely, like their own sound, their own voice, and to thrive. And then around, I want to say it was like 97 maybe or something, I want around there, BET came to Canada. And even then you saw the impact of that on the way our artists sounded. You know, they started to like, I think, you know, we had Toronto's version of Mobb Deep, or we had Toronto's version of blah, blah, blah. Like, it was just like, okay, now this is just like carbon copies of what you're seeing. And it was influencing the culture, especially hip hop culture, drastically. And so, if it wasn't for that mandatory 35%, I just think we would just, it's protecting our creative arts really across the board, from complete, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, just being usurped completely by American content. And that's not to say that I don't love American content. I do. And I'm in the States pretty much as I'm in Canada. And I consider myself a fish in water in both places, but it's just, it's important to protect our voice, our identity, our sound, and even the ability for ourselves to thrive as artists in Canada, which is already still difficult. Was more difficult probably pre-Drake. Drake made it more of an industry than it was before. You know, Canadian, as a side point, Canadian music industry has historically always been very white, very folk and singer-songwriter focused. And so, you know, breaking that as a quote-unquote urban artist or whatever you want to call it, a hip-hop artist, has always been difficult unless you sing and play the guitar like some of our rappers do. But it's been hard, you know, like there's just an amazing podcast that I'd recommend called This Is Not About Drake, or This Podcast Is Not About Drake or something. But my friend Ty Harper put it together, and it's about the hip-hop, the development of the hip-hop scene in Canada pre-Drake, and also, you know, the challenges that people faced and how things changed when Drake came around. Because really, as an infrastructure, like, you know, Cardi was dropping singles with Akon that were huge around the world and still not getting love on radio or in the media as much as like in Canada. It was just like there was no outlet for that kind of music in a way that would sustain and support you. So I don't know if I'm summarizing this correctly, but just to say the 35% is the least, is just the bare minimum of what we require to hopefully thrive with as Canadian artists with Canadian identity.
How does that, I mean, I imagine there's a, yeah, I talked about, you know, discovering, I guess, Black Star, right, in 97,
yes,
98. And,
yes.
And, you know, then I did a radio show in college, and it was like the underground hip-hop show. And, you know, it was against whatever commercial stuff was being played on the radio.
I came up in a very similar vein.
So how does that, I guess, what's the underground hip-hop experience or music in Canada versus, the commercial hip-hop music? How does that argument maybe play out with, and then it kind of tying in the 35% that of artists you want to hear on the radio. I mean, ours, like, so now that Drake is, you know, Drake obviously the most popular hip hop artist, I think, in the world right now. You know, he if you play him on the radio, he's part of that 35%, correct?
Yeah, right. Which I'm sure impacts everyone else drastically.
right, exactly.
yeah. I mean, that's an interesting question. I can only speak, you know, I'd say post 2000, I spent probably as much time stateside as I did in Canada. So I'm like not as clued into, for example, I was in New York City. When I moved to New York, nobody knew who Drake was outside of being the actor on that show that he was on.
Degrassi,
yes, of course. And then, you know, I came back a couple of years later and I was like, this guy was the hottest shit. And I was like, whoa, what just happened? You know? So there's definitely been segments of Toronto's hip hop history and Canadian hip hop history that I've been not plugged into. But I will say that in the '90s, it felt like anybody that was doing hip hop in Canada was immediately independent or underground just by virtue of the fact that the infrastructure wasn't there and it wasn't, you know, Canadian, the music industry wasn't really supporting hip hop that much. Other than things like college radio and, you know, stuff like that. So, and a couple shows on Much Music, which is our version of MTV, but just very limited airtime. And they and I think the VJs of those shows, the producers or the creators of those shows would have to tell you how much they fought to even get those shows on the air. So that being said, you were kind of always independent or underground if you were doing hip hop in Canada. Now that's different, I'm sure. And I don't know that experience. I've been independent my whole life, underground my whole life, kind of by necessity, although also I'm very, you know, I like to be in control of my image and my sound. So I probably wouldn't have fit into the major label model anyways, of like the, we're marketing a Coke bottle kind of thing. We're marketing a product. That's just not my ethos musically, but yeah, I think it'd be interesting to know now where artists in Canada, hip hop artists, place themselves on the scale of independent or underground versus mainstream or commercial. I don't know about the labels there. I remember at the time, like, knowing everybody that were like, you always knew the A&Rs at the major labels in Canada, which is like, you know, the department or the subsidiary of the American one, right? Thinking about Universal Music or Sony or whatever. You'd always know the like urban A&R, like everybody knew them and that person held so much power. But even then it's like, how much could they negotiate for their artists? How big was their budget for their artists? I think they struggled as well to kind of do their artist justice, even the ones that did sign to majors. I'm thinking about people like Cardi or Chaos, who was huge, or, you know, other artists like that. So yeah, I don't know. I think those people held a lot of weight and a lot of sway and a lot of influence in our community. But I think on the larger scale of the music industry as a whole, they probably were still relegated to, you know, their hands were tied in a lot of ways.
As someone who many moons ago once you got out of college, was helping edit, you know, education grants, I was interested when I learned about the, you know, grant writing or grant process for artists when they decide to create music or make music, and that kind of process, how it works, mm-hmm. Reaching out to organizations or government entities. Can you talk about how that has helped you, the grant writing part has helped you in your career, but also the amount of work that it takes to get these grants and kind of the deadlines that you're under, or even the, what you have to, you know, I mean, you know, with grant writing, you always have to show that you're, the progress you're making to prove that you're not using the money just to use the money. Can you talk about kind of this whole process of it?
Yeah, it's definitely changed over the years. So first of all, grants for me in Canada have been a game changer. They are the infrastructure. So in Canada, we didn't have the label backing or financial support. We had grants. And even people that were signed to majors still relied on the grants. Whether you're major or underground, the grants was the financial infrastructure. So there was the 35% CanCon that has to be played, and the grants were the financial, also from the government, were financial infrastructure to help actually just create artistic Canadian content across the board, whether hip hop or not. And without it, there might not be, like, you know, we'd be swept away. And so early on, I accessed a lot of grants. I learned how to write grants through a manager I had at the time, who was the same age as me and just learning. And, you know, we would kind of do them together. And then after a while, I was writing grants on my own. I can say as a side point, I know so many artists and so many people that are creatives that are like, F school, you don't need university. Well, I'll tell you this. I don't know a single artist, and forgive me if I'm wrong, I don't know a single artist that didn't go to university that can do those grants without somebody else's help. If there's one major thing that I learned, and I specifically, you know, I was at Ryerson for journalism, and writing was one of my main, you know, majors, I guess you could say, in my 4-year program. But like, if I didn't go to university, I don't think that I could navigate the grant writing system properly and effectively. So that's one major plus for just getting a degree, is just learning how to write those grants. Because it was very similar to me. Like, it's like, similar to an assignment in school. If your professor says, okay, you know, you have to do your thesis statement and write your essay, and these are the things that I need you to prove, the grant was similar. It was like, you know, these are the points you need to cover. This is what we need to know. This is, you know, this is how you're being rated. Very much like an academic scholastic thing. And so I think that I excelled at grant writing because I excelled in school. So just a side note for people who are wondering whether school is worth it. But yeah, so I've lost count. I mean, upwards of $100,000. I don't know if we're upwards of $200,000 now, but definitely. And for Canada, I know that doesn't sound like a large budget with American budgets, but for Canada, that's a significant amount of money. Never a penny in my pocket, but always money that went directly towards creating. So money for creating an album, money for marketing an album, money for music videos, money for touring, money for all different things, you know, and they're very strict. It sounds like, ooh, this gold, this pot of gold, you know, that you just access. They're extremely strict. And if you've, as you have written grants and received grants, you know how strict it can be. And you really have to know how to navigate that. some more strict than others, actually. I think I struggle a lot with the grants where you have to kind of prove that you're like commercially viable through your numbers, whether that be actual sales or your, for example, your social numbers. Like now it's all about your socials and how much numbers you have on your socials. And that I struggle with. I think I presently, although I, in the past I did receive those grants, presently I do better with the grants that are more artistic based. So they're looking more at the merit of you as an artist and your sound and your vision and how feasible your project goals are than they are, okay, how popular are you? You know, the popularity contest thing. So there's different types of grants and you kind of have to know your audience when you're writing to them and what it is that they're actually caring about. And every single, you know, jury, I actually sit on a jury for Factor Canada, which is notoriously one of the more, I guess you could say, industry-based grants where it's like really about like how poppin' are you? You know what I'm saying? And I've sat on a couple of those jury rounds, but you kind of have to know your audience when you write grants because some juries are going to care more about how poppin' are you, and other juries are going to care more about just your artistic vision and your project goals. So yeah, and of course the music and how it sounds is always integral and essential to those applications. But I'm not sure if I'm like losing track of your actual question, but for me, I would just say that I would not. None of my music or most of my music would not exist without grants. And on a personal note, I actually have always been someone who needed a deadline, an external deadline imposed by someone else, not my own, to complete anything. That's just the way I operate in that paradigm. So unlike a lot of artists, I know a lot of creatives hate that. They actually don't like working to deadlines. And I'm the opposite. I thrive with deadlines. So if it wasn't for grants, forget the money. I just might not have an album because I wouldn't be focused enough or driven enough. But I think the minute someone else says, okay, this is when it's due, I'm like, all right, go time. Cause I don't like to let people down and I like to be a person of our word. And I like to, I guess I'm an achiever or something or an over. I always like to get A's in school. You know what I'm saying? So for me, it was like this grant body that just gave me a bunch of money is telling me it's due this time. All right, I'm on it, you know? So I think even just the motivation, I would say, to complete projects came a lot from writing those grants. So yeah, every album, not the mixtapes, but every album I've dropped has been financed, not entirely by grants. And it's not like we had an abundance of money and the money has actually gotten smaller and smaller and smaller over the years. You'd think it'd be the opposite. The largest grants I received was when I was younger, but, and now they're quite small, the budgets, but that it's a beautiful thing. And I'm really grateful to Canada for that as an option.
I don't want to stick on grants, but the creative process wise, are you before writing, before going to apply for the grant, are you creating the music prior to that, or are you waiting to get the money and then create the music? Because I feel like there's that extra pressure once you get the money, like, oh shit, I gotta make music now.
A little bit of both, but usually most of the grants I apply to do not want you to have created the music before you apply. So if you have created the music, you kind of have to pretend like you haven't. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
But most of the time I'm creating either from scratch or I might have some drafts, some scratch tracks, but they're not close to completion yet. I'm just one C and I can't be everything to everybody. No reason, no logic, mad superstars lack content.
Don't rock it, find a new topic. I want to turn to your music. You know, you debuted your album. It's called Life in 2005, which was nominated for Rap Record of the Year at the 2006 Juno Awards. Your last album, At Last, was 2011. And now you're about to release this new album. When you first started, what did you want to bring to this art and to the culture? And what did you want to get from the art and the culture?
A very good question. And I might mention that At Last was nominated as well. So,
oh, nice. Sorry about that.
Yeah. No, you're fine. That's it. So what was my intention and what was I hoping to get from the culture? Is that the question?
Yeah. What did you want to give to the culture and what did you want to get to the from the culture?
Give and get. Wow. That's a very good question. I don't know if I've ever quantified that in my own mind. What did I want to give? What did I want to get? I think what I wanted to give was just a very honest perspective. Coming from my heart, a very vulnerable and transparent and real depiction of whatever it is I'm an expert in. And the only thing I can say I'm an expert in is my experience, really. So I think there was a bit of that I wanted to give. I always held myself just to, yeah, everyone's motivated by different things. I was motivated to express. Hip hop was always a form of, I guess you could say, therapy for me, and to be as vulnerable and honest as possible. although some of my tracks are more like, you know, you still have those joints where you're like, yeah, I'm better than you. But right. In general, those weren't the ones that I wanted to focus on or get excited about. It was really just the, let me show you my heart. I think that was what I wanted to do, is I wanted to be as honest as possible. It's funny, Janis Joplin, I quoted her in the track Goodbye, and it was like, to be righteous to myself, to be real. She says that. And I like that, the concept of being righteous. Not righteous as in like spiritually righteous, but righteous as in just keeping it 100. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I think that was probably off the top of my head. I could list many, but off the top of my head, that was the main thing that I was trying to give to the culture. And also it's nice to be a different voice. I think that there's a lot of the same thing in hip hop. There always has been, and they're predominantly Black male voices, which is necessary. But I just think it was important to be an honest and transparent real voice that happens to be different than Black male. You know what I'm saying? And that's, I really value across the board, not just in hip hop culture, but in any culture, I value diversity. You know, church culture needs diversity. Every culture needs diversity. Corporate culture needs diversity, and hip hop does too. So I think it was important to be a voice that, that did bring different things to the table, because by virtue of the fact that just my identity is different, you know? Right. So that's what I wanted to give, a diverse and honest and vulnerable perspective, and just, and do the best that I can do with that, in terms of my art, just be as honest as possible. And what I wanted to get from the culture, I think when you're young, what you want to get from the culture is very kind of simplistic and basic. It's just kind of like, I just want to be respected by my audience and my peers. And I always wanted to be, I think for me personally, as a, I'm actually Middle Eastern, but perceived as, you know, just Caucasian, as a white girl from Canada. I think I wanted to be respected by people that I considered the hip hop greats. Cause it just felt like I felt like most of my career, I was just fighting for some form of respect or recognition, because anywhere I went, it was just kind of like, yeah, right. Like when I came up in hip hop, nobody really looked like me that was at the hip hop venues or the concerts. There was a couple girls in the room. Most of them were just the girlfriends of whatever dudes were there. You know, were they heads? Yeah, they probably were. But like, you know, it was just very rare that there was participants. They were there, but they were just rare. And so I think being the perennial underdog and being the one that's constantly underestimated for the longest time, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, my what I wanted to get, like I was just trying to prove myself and be accepted by hip hop culture, you know, as someone that was perceived as somewhat of an outsider. And then once I realized that I didn't have to do that anymore, probably around At Last, I'd say, like, that's how many years, and I was doing it since the 90s, and that was 2010. So I think probably around At Last, I realized, oh shit, like, I don't need to like prove myself. I don't need to earn my place in hip hop anymore. And at that point, I think anything I got from hip hop culture, especially I think about the community and the people, was just a bonus. It was just like this loving reciprocal exchange of like just energy, you know what I'm saying? It was beautiful to be honored by people that I admired growing up, like DJ Premier, for example, or The Source, or like these things that like were markers, you know? It's like, ooh, like this, you know, this outlet that really knows their hip hop is giving me a good review or something. That was cool. That meant a lot, especially as a white chick from Canada. But what I wanted to get, I think at this stage of the game, presently, if I could speak for right now, my goal or my reason for creating is simply because it's in me. And I think in order to honor ourselves, we need to, you know, whatever's inside needs to come out. So it's in me. It needs to come out. Whatever happens after that is none of my business. Meaning, if tons of people love the record, that's wonderful. If nobody listens to the record, sure, that will be disappointing, but that's not my business. Like, it's like, I did my job. My job was to empty myself of myself, you know? And so at this point, what I get from it is just a bonus.
I mean, you know, you look at your discography, right? And then, and as you mentioned, At Last, 2010 was, you know, the last album you made prior to the one that's about to drop. And yeah, I know you dropped a few singles in between this time, but you know, essentially as a fan, if I look at it, I'm like, wow, why, you know, Attorney is not making music anymore, right?
Yeah, I know.
And please answer this as little as you want, as much as you want. But you know, I can't imagine walking away from anything that you're, one, you love, two, you're really good at.
and how much of a decision or hard of a decision it was to make. If you can, if you want to, please, would you talk about the process of why, you know, why did you walk away, or maybe why did you stop making albums?
Yeah, I still to this very day, and it's been over a decade ago, I still to this very day feel very conflicted about my decisions. And I like to say I don't live with regrets, but I do wonder often, man, like, was that like the worst decision I ever made in my life? And by that, I mean, specifically moving away from New York City in 2013, because I feel like moving away from New York was also kind of stepping away from being an active full-time hip hop artist. So as you mentioned, I did hit some stages, I did drop some singles, but I wasn't actively recording albums and touring. And so it was almost like I wasn't, you know, like I just disappeared. And there's this line in most people, and I feel like it summarizes it better than I can here. And I wrote in that song, I said, I don't know if it was God or my sin, self-sabotage or wisdom of the ages kicking in. All I know is I left. And now when I look back, I often wonder if I missed my one shot for impact. And that's how I feel, because when I left, really the glass ceiling was breaking and the doors, the gatekeepers that held doors closed for many people were opening wide for me. So it definitely felt like an inopportune time. A lot of it was just circumstances, things happening around me that led to that decision. I could say it was God too. Like, I'm always seeking God. I'm always praying. I'm always, okay, what do you want, God? And I do think there's a part of me that feels like my relationship with hip hop was not calibrated or aligned properly. So it had become the slave driver in a sense, or my desires for it, or just like my need for whatever to be successful at it had become the slave driver, and I was more of the slave. And so I think that really needed to be recalibrated. That happens a lot, but for people that get like knee deep into the music industry, it's like at first you're doing it for the love, and then all of a sudden it's like you kind of feel like you have to, and then it becomes like this warped relationship. So I think there was a little bit of that that required recalibration, which required stepping back. But at the time, I can't tell you this is why I did it. Now I'm in hindsight, I'm trying to explain it, you know what I'm saying? But ultimately, you know, I took a hit emotionally, mentally. I had like a mental health crisis I want to say 2016. And I think in hindsight, a large part of that, like a work burnout, I was actually working at a long-term care home, it was like this mental health burnout, which, by the way, side note, if you look up all the symptoms and what happens after you have a concussion, very similar, like almost identical. And a concussion is considered a head injury. So I just think that people should consider work burnout and mental health burnouts like a head injury, because there's so much information about concussions. And I had a concussion 6 months after I had my work burnout. And I was just like, yo, all of these symptoms I've been had already, like this whole time. You know what I'm saying? So that's interesting. Yes. Including like the physical stuff, like the dizziness and the nausea and all that. But anyways, what I wanted to say is I think a part of what I realized in hindsight after that work burnout was that came a lot from not basically like squashing my creative self. So like this part of me that needs to be active in order to not just thrive, but survive, that part had been like completely starved out. And I think that was a part of, you know, one of the things that led to that mental health burnout. So I think extremes beget extremes. I was all just hip hop and like trying to be successful, bar none. You know, relationships didn't matter as much, even friendships, my family, like I'm not saying I didn't love them, but they came second to my career. And then the pendulum shifted entirely in the other direction, where I was like, yo, I just want to do acts of service. I want to have this altruistic job where I work with people in their 90s. I want to just be around my family and my friends. Like, it was just kind of like I had been starved out when it came to the otherness, like being focused on others as opposed to focus on self. And yo, I don't care how like beautiful you are, if you're promoting yourself as a hip hop artist, you kind of need to like focus on yourself, because it's self-promotion. It's really, it can get ugly. You know what I'm saying? So I think that was what happened. It was just a natural pendulum shift, which had some like factors that happened in my life that kind of pushed it forward. But a natural pendulum shift from like complete self-promotion and focus on my career to complete, for the most part, like other focus and trying to be Mother Teresa, basically. And now I think I've hopefully landed, I'm a little more recalibrated and landed somewhere in the middle.
My follow-up question was going to be based on the lyric you had for This Life.
Yeah.
Which is on the second verse where it says, you spit, had to take a back, step back, reflect a little bit, reset intentions.
Yes.
And you obviously just answered that question.
Good quote. I love that song. And that's, and once again, I still don't know if I made the right or wrong decision, but it's just like, this is, at the end of the day, you just have to accept that that was, you know, a part of your life, necessary learning.
So when did you obviously wrote some tracks between 2010 and now.
Yes.
But when did you pick up a pen and start writing with the intent that this is going to be a part of an album?
Yeah. And for a while, I completely avoided that because it's almost like, I don't want to say trauma, but it's like the amount of energy I put into creating a record, recording a record, releasing a record, and promoting a record. We're not talking months. We're talking years. Like, it's not like what people do now. So I think you have to know you're signing up for that. And my husband, Mr. Lift, knows the same thing. It's like sometimes scary to pick up a pen and start writing a new record because you know what you're signing up for and you don't half-ass shit. Like, we don't half-ass shit. You know what I'm saying? So it's knowing that you're signing up for something that can be all-consuming. So, to answer your question, probably, so as I mentioned, grants have always been the reason why I got shit done. So I felt well enough to write a grant for an album in 2018, spring of 2018. The grant was actually for an album with Moss, a follow-up record that was going to be called Amen. Mm-hmm. And we received notice that we got the grant in September, and it was due, I think, 2 years from that point. I had given myself a good leeway. It was supposed to be like a 10-year anniversary thing in 2020. And, you know, a lot of things changed and happened, and Moss wasn't really able to work on the album when I needed to work on the album. And so with his blessing, we actually switched the project over to Rel, who is totally worthy. And he might not be as known as Moss, but his caliber of production and personhood is just as high in my mind, and just as equal. And we switched to, like, a year later. We kind of recalibrated the entire project, switched over to Rel doing all the production, and the rest is history, and that's where we get this album. So once again, it started with writing a grant. My loyalty runs deeper than the deep blue. A few that get my respect, they saw a gem in me when most people were tuned into what you do. Or you, most of them were dudes. I'm used to that too. Ain't no complaining, that's just the rules. Been invisible and broke my way through the glass ceiling. Folks calling like they always supported. That ain't the truth, but I'll take it though. Right. I remember those times. Most people on my phone, now my ringer's on silent. Fat on top of the world on some tipping point shit. You know, a lot happens. Obviously, in 11 years, you have a 2-year-old. You're about to become a mother again for the second time. Yes.
You know, you
literally. I can go into labor in this interview right now.
I'll call the doctor.
33 weeks. Yeah.
So a lot obviously happens between, you know, the 11 years. And obviously your writing process is, I imagine, has changed at all because you're writing for different, you're writing for, as you mentioned, you know, I think, as you mentioned, you're kind of writing for yourself in a way, right? But also, you know, children have a big impact on that as well. Do you find yourself with your child, do you find yourself writing differently, I guess, with being, because you're a mother now? Is that a factor? Is your child a factor into what lyrics you might put out there?
Not consciously. Like, when I write, not consciously, but definitely on a subconscious or unconscious level, absolutely. Just because I'm sure the actual cellular, like my cellular being, I'm sure has changed since becoming a mother, let alone the way I see the world and my future and everything in it. So I think it would be ignorant for me to say, oh no, it doesn't impact the way I write. But I don't think when I put the pen to the page, I'm not thinking directly about, ooh, what will Parrish think if he hears this in 20 years. But I've always tried to write music that can be timeless, hopefully, in terms of its messages. And I think I've changed a lot as a person by virtue of becoming a wife and a mother. It's been a lot of, like, it's been very humbling. It can be humbling, it can be lonely, it can be isolating, but it's been very humbling for me to become a wife and a mother after being, like, kind of the center of my own universe, as Eternia is. So if you watch He-Man. So yeah, I think that's the simplest way to answer that question. It's just, like, not intentionally, but I'm sure it has impacted my writing.
The name of the album, Free, is a name that really jumps out at you and really stands out to me.
Thank you.
Can you talk about can you break down the importance of this title for you?
So funny how it's changed in my mind in terms of what it means over the years, like since we started. So when we started, Free kind of meant the intention behind how we wanted to make this record. We wanted to make it in freedom. We wanted to feel free when we were making it. We didn't want to feel in any way stressed or confined to industry standards or what you should do when you're making a rap record. There's a lot of rules, especially with certain types of, I don't know, independent or underground, boom bap, golden era, whatever hip hop you want to describe my music as. There's often these like constraints, these unwritten rules. And I just kind of wanted to break free of all of that. Especially things like, you know, the kind of features you need on your album. I'm like, F that. Like, I just want to work with people that I love their energy and I hang out with them outside of making music because they're just really cool people. So yes, it was the intention behind the album was to feel free. And I think subsequently that meaning has changed in a number of ways. Like, I think it got deeper than that. I think there's a lot of kind of references in the album to spiritual freedom, true freedom, the kind of freedom that, you know, Nelson Mandela could even feel while imprisoned, you know, like freedom of spirit, even if your body is not free or if your circumstances in life don't feel free. There's some spiritual elements to that title. And then also my joke is that near the end of the record, when I was trying to wrap it up and we did have to apply for extensions for this deadline and that we had, it was just like, yo, I'm gonna feel free when this album drops. I'm not free now, but once the album drops, then it's like, woo, freedom. So it's meant a couple different things over the years. But yeah, I think that there's a theme and a focus on the album as a whole in this pursuit of mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual freedom that can be very elusive. So there's like that tension between feeling free, which to me is like a state of mind and a state of being, and then all the things that we battle with in our life, specifically inside, you know, the battlefield of the mind. So whether that be anxiety or insecurity or jealousy or tension or fear or doubt or depression, like these things that we battle with in our search or our desire to feel free.
If you take us to the first single on video, most people, it takes place in Queens, New York.
Yes.
What is this? And I saw Steinway, so I knew right away. What's the significance of Queens, New York, as the person, but also as an artist?
Yeah, I'd say unequivocally, and this might be a controversial statement for me to make as a Canadian, but unequivocally, the place that I feel most at home is that block that you see the signs for in that video. More at home even than in Toronto. I moved to Queens, specifically Astoria, in 2005. Well, the end of 2005. I was actually in Jersey for a year, and then I moved there, so like closer to 2006. I was there until 2013. And that doesn't sound like a long time, but for me, that's actually the longest I've ever lived in one place in my entire life, including childhood. So it's like a lifetime to me. And the people that were there, my neighbors, and everything about that neighborhood, which actually wasn't where I was doing most of my hip hop. Where I was doing most of my stuff was in the city or in Brooklyn or in other places. But just coming home to that place every day was the most grounding and anchoring thing. And I also found that I really connected and related to the culture and the people there, which were, by the way, like older Italian families. You know, I'm talking like people 50 plus that became dear family, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. That became family. And I think a reason why I just felt so at home, one of the reasons is I've always been very loud, actual audibly loud. And I've always spoken my mind in a way that can offend people that aren't so direct. But for me, it's never been offensive. It's just been, I'm like actually no filter telling you what I think. And anybody that knows me my entire life, even from childhood, would I think describe me as that. Just somebody that, you know, I'll tell you what I think without a filter. And so moving there was like I was finally with my own kind. You know what I'm saying? Because if you know anything about Italian families, if you know anything, like, it's just like they're loud
And they will tell you, especially like Italian New Yorkers, they're loud and they will tell you what they think without a moment's hesitation. They're not going to like put a filter on that shit. And so I just remember just being like, oh man, I finally found my people. Like, I'm just like, because everywhere else I went, I was like an elephant in a china shop. It's like, I'm offending people left and right, not even trying to. I'm just like, yo, I'm not trying to offend you. I'm just trying to tell you what it is. So, and New York City in general is more, people don't have time for the extra pleasantries. They don't have time to go out of their way to be polite. They're just like, yo, like no matter where you go, people are just telling, like they don't have time for that shit, so they just tell you exactly what it is. And I really appreciated that about the culture of New York City in general, and then specifically about where I lived in Queens. So I think for me, and also, I mean, in addition to that, my highest height of my career in hip hop, you know, the biggest peaks that I had reached personally, professionally, was when I was living there. So altogether, it's just like this bundle of like home. If I was to describe what home feels like, that's what it is. The minute I walk out of Steinway Station and I'm on that block, I'm just home.
So there's a line that stands out and on the track, and this line is, most people look at me like, who let her in the spot? And it stands out because I have to tell you a story I heard about you at South Paul Club in Brooklyn a while back.
Yes, which is also home. South Paul is family. Yes, continue.
So he's a DJ was telling me a story that he, you know, there was a cypher going on, and not just like local MCs, but like Buckshot, I think, might have hopped on stage. And then you hopped on stage, and the DJ at the time, kind of you stood out to him, and like, you know, who is this girl? And he really like wanted to test you and your skills, and he kind of, I think he made him, you know, mess up the beat or whatever. And he said she didn't falter at all, and she destroyed it. And I just wonder, like, take us back. How do you get this confidence to, you know, go up on stage with just like a bunch of dudes and an MCs and DJs that are trying to mess you up and test you? And where does this confidence come from? But also then how do you overcome this, where I mean, this burden that, you know, how does this burden of testing not get too much for you?
That's a very good question. I really appreciate that. Thank you. I will say this, after a while, it's almost become invisible to me. I always said I was like a horse with shutters on, like on my eyes, whatever you call those blinders.
Right.
In the sense that people that were doing shit like that, it's almost like I didn't even notice. Like it was just like water off a duck's back at a certain point, but you build up the immunity. And I would say a couple things. I'd say a part of it's just personality and how I was born and my genetics. My father had an insane amount of confidence bordering on, I don't know, you know, what is it when you're a masochist or whatever? Like, he's just like, or like, you know, he just is super confident. I come from, my father's side of the family are from Turkey. They're from a small village and they're like, just like, we are royalty. Like, so I imbued in me was a bit of that since I was very young. Like, hey, like you're, you know, you carry yourself a certain way when it comes to always being around dudes, which yes, I was predominantly always shoved in ciphers or on stages or in clubs or wherever, just me and a bunch of dudes. That I think was also natural for me by virtue of the fact that my father owned a nightclub and we were often there as kids, and my father's underlings or the people that worked for him, I guess you could say, were all like these like crazy burly tatted up like scary looking biker dudes, you know. And those like my babysitters when I was like three, you know? And so for me, when I see dudes that might look intimidating physically, I'm just like, oh, like you're like a teddy bear to me. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, because yeah. I was raised around these people. They were my babysitters. So I think just being in a room that's all men, being in a room that's all men that also like, you're like, yo, am I safe? Like, this is something that I was quite comfortable with just by virtue of how I was raised with my father. So that was something that in hindsight, it took me many years to realize that in hindsight, I'm like, oh yeah, that was kind of like something that I was trained for. I always had more male friends than female friends growing up, which a lot of women will say, but especially women in hip hop. So for me, I felt very comfortable. You know, male friendships were just kind of where I was actually more comfortable than female friendships for a long time. And so there's all that. And then the thick skin stuff is just like, you develop that over time. Yeah, you develop that over time, and you have to, I think, no more than anything, you just kind of have to have this sense of, like, you know, when people say, oh, what will they think? Like this quote unquote, they,
yeah.
yeah. this elusive who are they, you know? I always thought that was bullshit. I was raised by two very independent people. My mother and my father both don't really care about they too much. You know what I'm saying? So I was naturally raised like, yeah, no, like, and my brother and my sister are the same way. I don't think we care too much about they, you know? So I think a lot of it was just having confidence in yourself, knowing, yes, I believe I can rap. I believe I'm good. And then whatever, whoever they are, they don't get a vote. They don't matter. And that's not to say that comments didn't hurt me. I learned very early on, especially when it came to comments in blogs, or like we're talking like even in the 90s and like those bulletin board rooms or whatever, comments underneath your videos and YouTube. Like I learned early not to scroll down. Like back in the day, all of my comments, like it would be an amazing article. Like it could have been an article in like Hip Hop DX or something, and it would be like really positive, you know? And then all the comments underneath would be like the most demeaning shit you've ever read in your life. Really demeaning shit. And I learned early on, and by early on, I just mean like previous to 2005, before my first album, I just learned you don't scroll down. Just don't scroll down. Like that's the biggest advice I would give other female MCs. It's just like, yeah, don't scroll down. Like you don't need to hear that peanut gallery shit. It's irrelevant to you. So yeah, there's a little bit of everything there. And then of course, just over time, being supported by, I must mention this, it doesn't all come from within me, being supported by people that do matter to you in your life, that do say, yo, we're going to put our money or our time or our energy or our whatever behind you to support you because we believe that you are worthy of being in this spot in hip hop. That really fortifies you because I always said I would choose what information to take in and allow to seep into my consciousness and my being. And I would try my best to choose those things that were, there's a scripture I love. It's like, whatever is, I'm butchering it, but it's like, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good rapport, whatever is honorable, whatever is, you know, whatever, honest, think about these things, meditate on these things. So in my life, I've done my best to try and only take in that kind of feedback. I don't mind critical feedback as well from people that love me, but taking on the kind of feedback that you know is constructive, not destructive.
And in the video, you do give, you put up names to give, you know, shout outs and, you know, yes. Obviously thank yous of support. And, yes. You know, four names that really, I mean, a lot of names stand out to me, but there's four names that stand out because I think the lyrics that accompanied it stood out to me as well. And the names are DJ Premier, DJ Eclipse, Mr. Liff, and MERS.
Yeah.
And these lyrics are, and these four names are accompanied with the lyrics when you spit. And I hopefully don't butcher this too much. Most of them were
used to that too. Ain't no complaining. That's just the rules. Been invisible and broke my way through the glass ceiling. Calling like they always supported, that ain't the truth.
Can you talk about kind of the significance of each of these artists to you in your career and as an MC?
Wow, yeah, sure. So one of the inspirations behind all the names that I put up in most people, including those people, were people that did not have to, whatever you want to call it, put their neck on the line for me or stick their head like neck out. Like they didn't have to do it. There's nothing in there career that necessarily they would benefit from supporting me, you know what I'm saying? And they all did. And so for me, that is like an extra point of gratitude because it's like, you didn't have to do this. You're bigger than me. You're in a position of power. You, everything's going fine for you. You don't have to look out for me. And so Premier, well, Eclipse, and actually I would say, well, okay. So Eclipse has always, well, since I moved to New York City, he's always just been someone who's like very, I would say, objective in a way, pragmatic. Like he's just like, yo, either you're dope or you're not. Like he doesn't like, it's not, there's no emotion involved. It's just like, yo, either you're dope or you're not. And he just tells it like it is. And so for him to just be like, yeah, like he told me this recently, but it's just like, I heard her. I didn't even see her. Didn't know what she looked like. Heard her. Was like, okay, this is dope. Like, you know what I mean? That's just a huge, but then because he thinks that like, there's this thing in New York specifically that I love, that there's this loyalty. So if you hear somebody and you think they're dope and you're in a position of what I would say power, whether that be with radio or with curating showcases, like, you know, Eclipse had a big hand in Rocksteady or whatever it is. It's like, you actually act on, I heard this and I think it's dope. Because a lot of people will hear me, by the way, and be like, yo, on the side, they'll be like, yo, you're dope. But you don't see their actions supporting that, you know?
Right, right.
And I don't expect it. I don't expect it. But it's nice when someone does. And Eclipse did consistently, not just once. Like he could do it once. He could be like, okay, come up to my radio show one day. And then that's it. But consistently,
He was playing the records consistently. He was inviting me on the show consistently. He was, you know, giving me a platform when he had an option to put people on stages, like consistently. He wasn't the only one, but definitely one of them. And I felt that. And I do think that even impacted Premiere. I'm not saying it was because of Eclipse. I also know that Moss was a production partner with Premiere when I started working on the album with Moss. But both, you know, coming from different angles, I think Premiere really trusts his wise counsel, and I think that Eclipse is somebody that he really trusts his ear. They share music with each other, and so Premiere, as I've been told, Premiere chooses what he wants to play, but he might get, you know, he might get some good music from E to check out, and so I think there was that, and obviously Moss played a huge role in kind of putting. But once again, I must mention, it's not because of Moss's production partnership with Premiere that I got love from Premiere. It's because the music was dope. So it's like, you know, luck is when preparedness meets opportunity. You know, you have to be prepared, and there's this opportunity here. And so yeah, once again, Premiere showing love to me. I remember when at last drop, we were up on his radio show at Satellite in the office, Sirius Satellite Radio in his office there, or the studio, pardon me, for like, I want to say 2 hours. And I want to say he cut up almost the entire record. Like, he was just playing almost the entire album for over an hour. And that's something that's just like unprecedented. I still don't really understand that. So yeah, people like Premiere, and once again, he'll just be like, yo, if it's dope, it's dope. Similar to E, you know, if it's dope, it's dope. There's no feelings or no emotions or no whatever politics. And I love that. I love people like that. Especially because they're so rare in the music business. And then MERS, same thing. So actually I have this amazing memory of MERS. It was 1997. At Rocksteady, and this was back when it was still in Gaelic Park in the Bronx, and then Manhattan Center would have like one of the main finale concerts on like the Sunday or whatever. And MERS was there that weekend. I was rolling with Apathy. I was in Demigods. And we were kind of all peers at that point. And actually, I didn't remember this. We had ciphered earlier that weekend in like a subway car in the Bronx leaving Gaelic Park. We had like all like just been in this crazy cipher together, which somebody has to have video footage of that. I'd love to see that. But I think MERS was there too. So we were like kind of like bucking up with him over the weekend. And maybe we had some mutual peoples. I don't know. I don't remember if it was just like a random thing or if we knew some people. But then on the Sunday, I had my rock. I always tell this story. God, forgive me, MERS. I had my lanyard, and it was like my 1997. It was 1997. Might have been the 20-year anniversary of Rocksteady. I don't remember, but I had my like my beautiful lanyard, and I remember him coming up to me, and he's just like, "Yo, let me have your lanyard." And I just remember looking at him like, "Who are you?" I'm like, "Are you crazy?" I'm like, "I'm not giving you my lanyard." Like, I just looked at him like he was crazy. I'm like, "I'm not giving you my lanyard." And but we were cool, you know, and he didn't take offense. I think he thought it was a long shot to begin with. But that's my first memory of MERS. And subsequently, like, we just always knew each other in the scene, in the independent scene. I'm thinking, like, kind of Def Jux days, you know, and always had respect for each other. And I think would often run into each other in different places, whether actually physically or just, you know, our names and different things. And then, of course, he blew the F up. I'm really proud of him. I think he's just a really great business model of how to do it independently and do it right. He's just a brilliant mind. And so over the years, once again, he didn't have to reach back and kind of pull me up. But there's been times where he's reached back and pulled me up and he didn't have to. And one of those times was putting me on like the main stage at Paid Dues in 2011. A bigger stage than at the time. Kendrick Lamar in 2011 rocked Paid Dues with his crew. But it was like a smaller stage than that. Like, it was the main stage. I hit it more than once that day because I jumped on again at the end of the day with Sage Francis. And it was probably one of the biggest moments in my career, I would say, in hindsight. Everyone was there that year, and it was just, and I was honored in a way that was like, no, this isn't just an up and coming person. Like, this is somebody who deserves to be here. And when you give someone like me, who is an underdog, that kind of spotlight, we take it, we run with it. And I think the crowd really accepted me, even though a lot of them, I probably had never heard of me before. Like, you know, I think there was over 10,000 people there that day. I don't remember how many. It was a lot. And they accepted me as I deserve to be on that stage, not who is this person, you know, like they wild out. And so stuff like that. And even now he is promoting the album on his IG stories, you know, he doesn't have to do that. And so, so yeah, and that's MERS. And then Lyft, oh man, like these stories are all so long in and of themselves. Sorry, but Lyft I met in 2000 at CMJ.
music festival in New York City. And when we met, we immediately hit it off, just on like a spiritual, cerebral level, beyond hip hop. But he always looked out for me. Again, did not have to. And my one main memory I have, although he did many, was I was in Australia a couple years later, 2004. And I just landed in Australia. Nobody really, I mean, some people knew. I had actually reached out to some heads to like try. I wanted to get into the hip hop scene there, like really take over, really. And some people knew about me and knew I was there, but really nobody knew. And I saw that Lyft was coming the same month that I landed. I think I got there end of February, and in March, he had a headlining show at this larger venue there. And I reached out to him, and I've done this maybe once in my career. Like, I don't normally ask people for shit, but I reached out to him and I was like, yo, can you let me open for you? And for him, it was nothing. He was like, of course. And I remember him having to have a conversation with the promoter. Like, when artists say to you, yes, you can open for me, what a promoter will do is be like, cool, I'm going to put her on so early, no one's going to see her. And then we're going to have some DJs and some of our local people, and then you can come on. And so an artist has to advocate, like they have to say, no, I mean, like right before me, like I want her to open for me. Like One Below used to do that too. He used to be like, no, like she's not going on early. She's going on right before me. You know what I'm saying? So One Below, his name should have been in that video. I don't know how I missed that. Lyft said, sure, no problem. And I killed a set for maybe 10 minutes right before he rocked. And it was a packed house, and he was the headliner. And that opened so many doors for me when it came to these 5 months that I lived in Australia, in Sydney, Australia, by virtue of just everybody who was in hip hop being at that show. And so things like that, like he did other stuff for me too. But things like that, are just game changers. You know what I'm saying? And once again, they don't have to do it, and they do it.
Right. I think that's the important part, right? Is that it's all of these artists. It's their credibility on the line too, right?
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
They're not going
in major ways.
Like if I can't rap for the life of me, but if I asked, like if I knew Premier, I was like, hey, can you put this on? He would definitely not, because he would be laughed out of the stadium. But
right.
So obviously, I appreciate all the time you've taken. I know we've been going for a while, and I just have one more question. You know, as we mentioned, first album in 11 years, lots have changed for you, not just as an artist, but in your personal life as well. And obviously the promotional aspect, I think, of music has changed a lot as well. Right. What happens now for you? I mean, you know, usually what happens is the album drops, you go on tour, you sell merch, you know, you tour for as much as you can to, you know, make as much as you want, you know, can for the album. Mm-hmm. And then you go home.
Yeah.
Is that the plan for you? I mean, I know you mentioned like, well, it's not really, yeah. Like, you know, this album, it's called Free. So a lot of it's about, you know, it's for you. What do you want to do now?
Yeah. In terms of promoting the record or in life?
I feel that's a question I don't even know the answer to for myself.
Right. What do you want me to focus on in this answer?
I guess in terms of the album and the music.
So I'm actually grateful. I want to say in a sense I'm grateful for COVID, which I know is also a controversial statement, but it has moved a lot of things even more digitally and online and virtual than it ever was before. And that's really actually just helpful to me at this moment, being that I can't physically, just by virtue of how pregnant and I am, and also my family needs and all that, as a new mom of young children, I can't do what I used to do. And what I used to do might not even be relevant in the industry anymore. Who knows? But I can't just go and hit every radio show physically, go and hit every stage that I'm invited on physically, and just be all up in the spots everywhere that I need to be to remind people that this album exists, which is exactly what I did for At Last and for It's Called Life. I can't do that. So the fact that now most things are done virtually is just such a blessing for me. I can still promote this record. I think in the past, publicists or promoters would have been like, yo, we can't help you with this album if you can't be out there touring. You know what I'm saying? But
right. But
now they can. And people almost don't expect you to tour. So it's a beautiful time for me for that. God's timing, divine timing. In terms of, and we're open, like Lyft and I in theory are like, yo, if the opportunity is right, we'll go wherever to do a show. But obviously things have to be drastically different if I'm bringing my family with me and all that. Right. And a newborn that's still breastfeeding. It's just like a whole different game, you know? I think
for me, if I could just speak on it on like a bigger level, yes, the game has changed completely and we're doing our best. Shout out to my publicist, Matt Diamond, Diamond Media, who's just been killing the game on a budget. Like just, you know, he puts his all into everything he does. He actually worked the Vanguard record that Lyft did with Stu Bangas, and it's one of the reasons why we signed him up for this, but he's just been killing the game. And my manager too, Sav, who always kind of played publicist roles in as a manager for me. But I think, you know, we're doing our best to do it justice. My motto has always been, do your best, God does the rest. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I know I crossed all my T's and dotted all my I's and gave it my best effort and it sinks, at least I can be like, all right, that's God's will because I did my best. You know what I'm saying? Like, but if I don't do my best, then it's on me, you know? So that's what we're doing. We're doing our best. Personally, I think it will be beautiful for this album to drop as it is before the baby comes. The baby's due like maybe 2 weeks after the album drops, could come earlier. Right. So, you know, the album drops, the baby comes, and then I'm actually dealing with like a health situation right now where they discovered cancer in my kidney. And so thankfully there's no, it's actually a blessing because it's early detection and there's actually no symptoms or anything. I'm not receiving treatment, but what happens with kidney cancer, renal cell carcinoma, is they actually just cut it out. Normally chemo's not the therapy. So they're waiting for me to give birth and then they're going to cut that out. So for me, it's like dropping this album is very symbolic of, I'm really glad I'm getting this out before my life changes drastically, perhaps, you know, in a bunch of ways. I don't know what ways. My life's going to change drastically having two kids instead of one. My life's going to change probably in some ways by having this kind of major surgery. So, and we hope it doesn't come back, but you never know, right? With cancer. So yeah, I think those things, like those other elements, the personal elements of my life have just been propelling me more to just give this all I got because it might be the last time. And I know artists always say that, but really and truly, you know, so I just gotta, I'm blessed to be able to do this. And it's also just, I'm talking a lot, but the last thing I'll say is it's kind of like the one aspect of my life right now that's like completely just me, like Eternia. It's not the mother or the wife or this medical patient or whatever. It's just like, I can just be fully in my identity when I'm even talking to you right now, Tim, in this interview. It's just very fulfilling for me. And so I think the process of promoting this, no matter what happens, is extremely fulfilling. It's very full circle.
So the new album is free with Rob McCoy, Eternia. It's really been truly an honor to finally talk to you on the Live and Rap, the Hip Hop Interviews, to Monica. I greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Rob.
They get my respect, they saw a gem and we went. Most people were tuned in to what you do, or you. Most of them were dudes, I'm used to that too. Ain't no complaining, that's just the rules. Been invisible and broke my way through the glass ceiling. Folks calling like they always supported. That ain't the truth, but I'll take it though. I remember those times, most people on my phone, now my ringer's on silent, felt on top of the world, on some tipping point shit, then I left before they could evict. The strange part of it is, I don't know if it was God or my sin, self-sabotage or wisdom of the ages kicking in, all I know is I